Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002. It goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Stella Clark, former BBC Governor and Housing Association Chair. And we have the weekly What's On Guide and Songs of the Week from Jeff Sparks. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. And I'll have a reminder of a phone number for both Volunteering Bristol and also for Bristol Bully Watch at the end of the show. But first of all, Stella Clark, hi and welcome to Dialect.
Hi.
First of all, Stella, it's a bit of a grand thing to have a Bristolian or someone who at least lives near Bristol being an ex-governor of the BBC. When did you first start and how did you come to be appointed?
Well, I was in the days when they started to say, we must have a woman on this. And in fact, amazingly, there were 12 governors of the BBC then, and there was only one woman who was about to retire.
So who was that?
Oh, she was a Scottish. Lady Abenside, I think her name was.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what were your credentials then? How come you were on the shortlist? Not just because you were a woman.
No. Well, I'd done a few other things, and I think one of the most important thing was that I did know the then Vice-Chancellor of Bristol University. They were looking for somebody, and the civil servants just weren't turning up anybody. Because actually, I think they never knew where to look. It was interesting later on when they did... I went to see Question Time on one occasion, when they just started on television. And there were some very interesting women on who weren't actually necessarily political. And I said to the producer, who was a woman, where are you finding all these interesting women? And she said, I find them all from other women, which I thought was a very interesting example. Anyway, the then chairman of the BBC, who was equally actually a Scot, and had been vice-chancellor up at Edinburgh University. And it was in the time of quite a bit of student unrest. And then...
What year are we talking about?
Oh, gosh. It was the end of the 70s, sort of towards the end of the 70s. I think it was about 75. I should have looked it up, but I didn't. And he wrote round to all his vice-chancellor friends and said, can you find me an independent woman, preferably non-metropolitan? So I became known as the non-metropolitan woman, which I was actually rather glad to be called in a way, because... awful lot of people get appointed to things when they're in London.
Okay, so how did you find it in that virtually all male world?
I'd started doing things in local government as a councillor, where there were very few women then. But you learn how to do that one, actually.
Did you find that there was a slightly patronising attitude towards you because you were a woman? Is that still around in the 70s?
It can be. But on the whole, I think then, people did try and be helpful, actually. And I didn't find it that difficult. Although sometimes you get out of the loop, if you like. I mean, people will talk about things to themselves. I mean, there's the old joke about... which loo you're in, whether it's the ladies or the gents, and more people talk in one than the other. So I got a bit left out of that one. But on the whole, I found lots of people sometimes wanted to talk about things, which they found slightly more difficult sometimes to do it with male colleagues.
Now, I know one of the criticisms of some of the governors I'm thinking about in the 1980s, Marmaduke Hussey, for example, was that a lot of the things that were being discussed at the BBC when he first was made governor apparently didn't even have a television in his house. Did you ever find sometimes you were discussing things as a governor which you didn't have full knowledge of? Maybe millions of people have watched programmes. Did you have to watch all these things, and were you given tapes to make sure you knew exactly what you were discussing?
No, I watched a lot. And in fact, I had a television. But then, and the BBC put the, made the aerial right, because actually we didn't have very good reception, so that was good. So the BBC came and crawled all over the roof, made sure it worked. And I went round a lot of the programme people. You could go anywhere. And I think that was very important. I'd learnt the job, if you do it, what I did later on and then, from being a local councillor in an independent council. So there was no politics. You had to learn for yourself and you had to convince other people of what you wanted. There was no caucus behind you. And I learnt more from that council than anything else.
Now, a lot of people look upon that period, I mean, the late 70s, early 80s, as a bit of a golden age, because we had a lot of politics came into the BBC in the mid-80s. In fact, broadcasting generally, it started to become more of a commercial organisation, being told, oh, you've got to compete internationally. So what was it like? How did you find, your little tours around the corporation?
There was a huge ethos for the BBC, huge. And in fact, people practically weren't spoken of. They went off to, say, HTV, as it was in those days here.
So it's very tribal.
It was a bit. But on the other hand, it was equally a huge feeling that this was a very important, which it was, organisation, setting the tone, setting standards. And there's no doubt about it that the standards that were set in those days and the earlier ones in the BBC, set it for the whole of the British television, I think.
OK, what about some of the controversies? Because you were there for a while. There must have been some things that came across the BBC board's table which were real nail-biting, you know, particularly when you've got two factions, political factions, using the BBC in a way as a whipping boy and fighting things out across the board table.
You didn't fight it out over the board table. I mean, I always think one of the interesting things, I've been on a number of different quangos, and the minute people get appointed on them and become part of a board, they actually drop their politics.
Do they really, or do they just say that?
No. I'm not silly. I know what they're up to. And that's one of the things about being a woman, you very often do know what people are up to. But there are always the odd people, who are the exception. But actually, most people didn't and don't. There was an interesting one when I was there, and that was much more about freedom of speech, as far as the BBC were concerned. Very important. We had the Idi Amin session. I don't know if you remember that, but Idi Amin had got very angry with the BBC's World Service.
He was a dictator, wasn't he, of Uganda?
Dictator in Uganda.
I mean, which, of course, was an ex-British colony.
That's right. And he had said that he was going to get rid of all the Asian immigrants. They weren't that immigrant. A lot of people had been there for generations. And that if the BBC didn't shut up, they were not only going to kick them out, but they were going to actually kill a whole lot of people. And I can remember a board meeting where we had to make a decision as to whether we were going to go on repeating Africa truthfully, as it was seen, or we saw it, or our reporters saw it, or whether we were going to bow down to this, in which case no one in Africa would ever believe us again. And we made that decision that we were going to continue as we had been with telling the truth as it was seen.
I mean, it's very difficult, though, isn't it? Because you're looking at it from the outside and you've got to try and be balanced. I mean, is the BBC able to do that in a post-colonial situation like that? I mean, we've seen a similar controversy with Zimbabwe as well recently. Them looking to the BBC as really the mouthpiece of an old colonial power that they really would rather shut up.
Of course. Well, and whether how much... I don't think there was quite so much of the old colonial power as possibly Robert Mugabe has sold all the time then. But the very real threat to people was very much there.
To individual reporters, are you talking about?
Well, no. I mean to the Asian population.
What was that about? Just remind us, because, yeah. I mean, there was a lot of migrants brought in, I suppose, under the colonial days into Uganda by the British colonial powers. And what was happening was that there was almost a kind of race war breaking out with the indigenous native people represented by Idi Amin saying, we don't want these people here. How do you report that in a balanced way? It's very difficult.
Yeah, it is difficult. But, I mean, they were people who'd been there for generations. I mean, people move around the world, as we've seen only too often now. You know, we happen to be seeing an exceptionally busy time at the moment. And if you look back in history, people have moved around, you know. Look at all of us. We're all from goodness knows where, you know, joined up.
Are there any characters around the table at the BBC board that you remember particularly?
Any what?
Characters.
Yes. And if I can remember all their names, that's my problem. There were some very interesting people, because we had very specific people representing. So, for instance, you had, we had Vic Feather on. We always had one trades unionist. Vic was a huge character. I don't know if you remember his name, but lots of people listening will. And he was head of the TUC. And was another man whose name I'm going to forget, but he actually was a Bristolian. And he was head of the Shop Workers Union, I remember. So other people will remember that. And those were there while I was there. And Vic particularly was a huge, huge character.
I mean, are we talking about he's able to make his point around the board in quite a humorous way and a way that will stick in your mind or what?
Oh, yeah. And he wasn't, you know, always ready to say something. Mind you, most of the people were ready to say something. I mean, one of the women there was, the mother of the man who now runs the Tate. Go on, there's one for you to remember.
Okay, well, we'll look that one up, yeah.
Well, I shall remember it in a minute. I should have written them down. But they were a very interesting bunch, but there were always, there was a representative who had been something like a diplomat, or because they were representing really the Foreign Service, as it was then. So there would have been someone like that, and they were interesting people. There was always someone representing Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. They were a great bunch. But there was never then anyone representing England, which is quite interesting.
Well, it's a bit like now,
England,
isn't it?
Where we have, gets left out.
Well, it does. We've got the Scottish Parliament, haven't we? The Welsh Parliament, and
right.
No English Parliament.
And we're back again to that. But if I think they now have an English representative as a trustee or whatever they're called now.
So when you were discussing things and deciding on policy for the corporation and I suppose even approving things like pay, that kind of thing, did you generally come to a consensus or did you ever have to vote? And are there any memorable votes you remember?
Michael Swan, who was the chairman, always used to do a consensus thing. He was like that. And if you said something that he didn't agree with, he would always say, "Now, that's a very interesting idea," and you knew that was a dead flop. That was not going to get through. But, it wasn't acrimonious in any way. It was actually a very interesting and enjoyable board to be on. And we used to have all senior managers who were running, you know, Radio 1, Radio 2, there'd be... So you got all of those, BBC 1, 2, obviously, and... they would be there, not always for the whole meeting, because we met every fortnight. It was quite a heavy...
Crikey, load. Yes, that is. More than fortnight. Most boards, isn't it?
And then we had a huge number of advisory councils, and I used to chair the board for the advisory councils, which included Northern Ireland and Scotland and Wales. And that was very interesting, because they also had... an agricultural advisory council, I'm not sure if they still do, and a religious advisory council, and I think a business one, yes, there were. And there was a general one. Well, there were the most amazing people on that, the sort of great and good who turned up being dancers and, you know, all sorts of people were on that.
Well, I mean, Northern Ireland, you mentioned there, that must have been a pretty hot one because, of course, the Troubles were going on in the late 70s, weren't they?
They were. I went over there a few times. And one of the things which is interesting was, there were two things, I suppose, that one hadn't really thought through. One was that people who were news people longed to go over there because the news was so tight and, you know, immediate. And the other thing was what a huge amount they learnt in the hospitals from people being damaged. So that the, I think it's Royal Victoria, isn't it, in Belfast, was absolutely in the forefront of all the sort of things like burns units and things like that, learning how to put people together again.
Well, it's good to see things have straightened themselves out in Ireland with Mo Mullen and the Good Friday Agreement, which has brought both sides together. That's lovely that we haven't got that these days. But anyway, you left in the early 1980s, the BBC. Yeah. Mm. What are your thoughts about the way things have gone since then? Because it's a very different corporation now. It's being told you've got to compete in the international market for international viewers. And essentially, there's not a lot of difference in the marketplace anyway between somewhere like BBC and Rupert Murdoch's Fox News or Sky.
Well, I'd argue with that, but never mind. We won't
have
they're
fighting in
now.
The same marketplace. Yeah,
it's the same marketplace, I quite agree with that. But I don't think it's done in quite the same way. It is very different, and yet in some ways it's the same. I mean, I do think that standards are hugely important. I mean, if you don't keep those up, forget the thing. But, and I do think that in many ways, some of the ways they've had to cut what they do. I mean, for instance, there was a hugely important makeup department where everybody's, and they were very good indeed at making up people, you know, for appearing on television, etc. But they equally had a very good school, which used to take a lot of apprentices, you know, to learn how to do things like that. That went. And the same things for, they had a, you know, dress department and clothes, you know, what my grandchildren would call dressing up stuff, you know, things like that. And that's gone. And I think, you know, those things which sort of led the way and taught people how to do things. An awful pity that had to go, but still, there you go. You don't get the licence fee you want, you don't.
The other thing, of course, is how the BBC, whether the BBC is prepared to challenge the establishment. Have you noticed any change in the spine of the BBC, I suppose, over the years?
Well, I was very disappointed that they got that sort of political hiccup that went on when Greg Dyke went. I thought that... I hope that wouldn't have happened at the same time.
That was all over the Iraq war, wasn't it? And Andrew Gilligan had been on the Today programme saying that the dossier that was used a reason for the Iraq invasion was so-called sexed up, essentially. And he was later, of course, proved right. But the government of the day managed to squeeze Greg Dyke out at the time. Why do you think that's important then? Because, I mean, it was almost inevitable, wasn't it, that because of the political furore over that Dyke wasn't going to survive it?
I think it's the way you play the game, as it were. I would have thought he could have. I was surprised he went, because he's quite a tough egg. And I think he was doing a good job at the BBC at that point, and I think it was a great pity because it needed somebody strong and to give people confidence. You know, if you don't think people are going to back you when you go out and having very difficult times, and it wasn't only that, it was the policy people too who were supporting, that particular government at the time, which has actually gone on. So civil servants are beginning to be not so well either recognised or paid attention to, I think. Which is important from our civil service point of view, that we get the right people who actually want to go and do it. Because very important thing we have in this country, I think.
I mean, it's very difficult for someone like Greg Dyke to carry on if he hasn't got the support of the governors at the time or the trust as they are now.
Agreed. But, I mean, the whole thing was they made it into a trust, which to me makes no sense at all.
Well,
I always thought I was a trustee for the public anyway.
So what's the difference between the BBC Trust, chaired by Lord Paton, as it is now, and the Board of Governors that you were on? What's the difference as you see it?
I'm not sure what it is, to be quite honest. I consider things are playing games when you say everybody must meet in a different building because they must be influenced otherwise by whatever they're doing. Nonsense. And that's the sort of thing that happened. They meet in a different building. They meet in Broadcasting House. And it was rather like in those days we used to go round and hold board meetings occasionally in different parts of the country, which was meant to be sort of showing your face, as it were, which probably most people had not a clue we were there. So I always thought that was a bit of nonsense. But you did have a dinner which you entertained a whole lot of people representative of different communities that you were going to, and that worked quite well. And we did do public meetings. I did a couple of public meetings. which is quite interesting in a way, because I'd grown up to be very much thinking I was us and not them. And you go to take a public meeting and suddenly you're them and not us. But I quite enjoyed doing it because I'd done that sort of thing, you know, as a local councillor. It didn't worry me that. But
okay, what about the more modern BBC, though? Do you think it does the cultural potential of the nation credit?
I think it could do better. I have great hopes of the new Director General. I think he's got an interesting man who's come and has been outside the BBC for a bit, running not a very easy organisation. And, well, Opera House, wasn't it? I mean, that's fairly noted for having all sorts of high-powered people all wanting to do different things. So I think that's an interesting one. And I dropped him a note to say, you know, good luck, roughly, and to remind him, actually, that Michael Swan, when he was chairman, used to say, wake up in the middle of the night and say, I wonder who's doing something that I'm going to have to answer for in the morning. You know, and I said, I hope this doesn't happen too often to you. And he dropped me back and said, not too bad, the sleeping habits so far.
Okay. Well, you've also, when you finished with the BBC, you went on to chair Housing Association in Bristol. Mm. That was in the mid-late 1980s. Tell us, what is a housing association and how did you, find that job?
Oh, it's very interesting because I've always been interested in housing, in public housing.
Why?
Well, because I came out from university at a time when people were actually, there was a huge problem with housing. I mean, it was...
Well, like now?
Not now, yes. Worse than now, much worse than now. And it was everybody living with the in-laws, you know, jolly lucky and generally a couple of children in the room as well, you know, that sort of thing. Very difficult to keep a marriage going as it was, and lots of difficult problems. And, you know, so I found that I wanted to do that, and that's what I did. And then I finished with local government because it became political. And to be quite honest, I'm not a politician.
And I mean, did you find a similar thing at the BBC as well? Or was it only in housing that you found politics coming into, you know, sort of almost circling around trying to influence things?
Well, I suppose, you know, you could argue that everybody manages in a sort of semi-political way with a small p. What I'm saying is I'm not political in that I don't fly a flag for any party. I wanted to go on doing housing because I was interested, and I knew quite a lot about it by then. I'd done 20 years in local government. And so when I was invited to go on Knightstone, which I did to start with before I became chairman, obviously, I found that extremely interesting because then particularly housing associations were looking at what was needed in quite imaginative ways, different ways of how they could do things, which is actually what we had done to a certain extent in local government, looking after sort of different areas. And Knightstone was doing very much the same thing, and it was local. And so it was a natural one for me to join, and not too big. Some of them very big now.
Now, I know you're still actually interested in housing, aren't you? Because you were one of the people behind a recent development in West Street in Bedminster. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, I chair something which is called Community Self-Build Agency. And I was asked to actually do that by the Housing Corporation, which I was on at the time, because they had a responsibility for looking after self-build.
Now, that was... It's now defunct, isn't it? But that's it was defunct. The government body.
It's something else now.
It was the government body that was supposed to be in charge of housing and funding housing associations,
correct,
making sure that there was plenty of money out there, yeah, for social housing.
That's right. It's called the Homes and Communities Agency now. We're always renaming things in this country, and I don't know how much difference it makes, but never mind, as long as we know what they're called. So I gradually became chairman of that. And the one I did in West Street is for... We've done it for quite a long time, actually, this. Mostly originally for young unemployed young men and women, to encourage them to sort of get back into life again, to build through building your own home and actually helping yourself.
So how can you persuade someone to build their own home if they don't actually own it at the end of it?
Well, it's an interesting thing, but I've asked a number of people this who've done it. And I said, what do you feel about this? And they say, no, you don't realise that when you actually build it, you get an ownership of it. And I do see that, actually. And they definitely do feel that. Because after all, do you own your house when you've got a heavy mortgage? It's, in a way, rent or mortgage, is some similarities about them. So, no, that's not a problem about that.
What are your thoughts about the current situation, though? Because it's very, very difficult for young people to get on the housing ladder. Should Britain be looking more like Germany, where more people are renting, or should we be trying to make house prices more realistic? Because, I mean, if you look at the actual cost of materials and the manpower that goes into building a house, I mean, you're paying well over the odds if you're spending. I was hearing just the other day on the radio, £1 million if you want to buy a house in Islington in London. Certainly the average is around about £200,000 for a basic house. It's much, much more than it actually costs to build it.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I think quite a lot of people feel that there's a flexibility in renting. So that if you're reasonably sort of young still, you may not necessarily stay in that place forever to work. If you've got a house you've got to sell and all the kerfuffle that goes with it and expense, it's probably better and more sensible to rent for a bit until you get to that stage. I mean, I think other people worry that, they miss the boat. I think that's what a lot of people think, that their prices will keep going up. Certainly in London they are.
But what I'm trying to say is, why is it so much more expensive to buy a house than it would be in actual materials and manpower to build it?
Well, it's what people will pay, isn't it? I mean, at the end of the day, quite a lot of them came down. I mean, there were people who say, if you can't sell a house, it's badly priced. And there may be something in that. I mean, if you can sell anything, I'm not suggesting you give it away, but you know what I mean. It's sometimes things were overpriced. I feel terribly for people trying to work in London. I think it's awful, how you actually manage.
Well, finish on the BBC, though, because I think that's one of the most fascinating things you've done, Stella. What are your thoughts about the Savills scandal? Because this was a massive last year, and the BBC itself tried to spike the story, didn't it? The Newsnight reporter Liz McKean had interviewed some of Savills' victims, and her boss said, well, this story isn't important enough. Well, it turned out to be the biggest story of the year.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, I was a governor at the time, but I never heard a dicky bird. And I went through all my old governor's minutes to see whether I could find any reference, and I couldn't. So I went up to Dame Jamet Smith's inquiry, because I thought I should. I thought probably the only person who's left alive who was still a governor then, because I was quite young as a governor, in fact. And it was actually, they were interested at the sort of level of involvement we had. They had no idea. The young barristers who were sort of involved in doing it. There's only one thing. I mean, I do know. I mean, I've heard obviously all sorts of things since about Jimmy Savile, but I do think it was a very different time. I mean, when you think that it was very much the time of pop stars and people trying to break into the rooms they had in hotels and all that sort of, nonsense going on. And lots of screaming people all over the place. You get a bit of that now, obviously you do, but the culture was different. And I think I'm not suggesting that anyone ever thought it was a good idea to be assaulting children or anything like that. I think a few girls put themselves in foolish places sometimes, but, that's life, isn't it?
And how do you think it's been dealt with at the BBC?
Well, I've been concerned since. Not so much about that. I mean, I'm sure there are some people who, well, I'm not sure they're still around, but I'm sure they're not around, who would wish they'd done something differently. But I'm actually concerned about the sort of way that newspapers at the moment are go for people. And it becomes a sort of kangaroo court, and I'm not talking about Jimmy Savile. All sorts of people who were, you know, and then wait months and months for cases to come up, and then it's dismissed.
Like, I mean, we've got this business with things like Rolf Harris, Dave Lee Travis. The bizarre thing, of course, is that the person who seems to have been by far the worst offender, if these other people were offenders at all, is Savile, who's dead and, of course, can't be prosecuted.
No, that's right. I mean, it's, you know, I don't know, but it's difficult to believe, isn't it, that all these people were behaving like that. But I'm not saying, I've no idea. I don't know, so I can't really say whether there's evidence or not. It was a bit strange, the chap the other day who was found not guilty. And then you got slightly worried about what was going on.
It's almost as if the police have let Savile get away, so they feel they've got to do something by nabbing some others.
I think there's a bit of dawn raiding going on.
Anyway, we'll have to see how those court cases pan out. We mustn't make any judgments beforehand, otherwise they'll have our guts for garters on, no doubt. But anyway, yes. Stella Clark, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Fine.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Well, joined by Jason Yannakopoulos. Hi again, Jason.
Hello, Tony.
Right, what have you got for us this week? Always there's loads and loads of stuff to talk about, thousands of things to talk
about.
Well,
I think we're going to start with press regulations. I think we'll start with what you can and can't talk about.
Ah, one of the things you can't talk about, of course, is the film about the death of Diana, which you had a little look at, didn't you? I gave you a copy of to look through. I hope you made lots of copies and passed them around to your friends, because it's totally banned, this film. Apparently the royal family wanted something like 70 or 80 cuts in the film, and threatened to take the filmmakers to court unless they made those cuts. And so the filmmakers, in their infinite wisdom, have decided that the British public are never going to see the film about the inquest into the death of Diana. But you have seen it, Jason. It's called Unlawful Killing. It was made in 2011 by Lily Allen's dad and the comedian Keith Allen, financed by Mohammed Al-Fayed. What's your review of this film that the British public are not allowed to see?
Well, It's certainly an eye-opener, let's say that. I mean, it goes into great details and provides a great deal of evidence into what can only be described as the conspiracy to murder Diana.
Well, one of the interesting things that this documentary did that no other documentaries, so I've seen, has done, was it actually looked very closely at the inquest, and they even had in this documentary somebody sitting amongst the journalists who were covering the inquests, or not covering the inquest, and the journalists were really, I suppose, rather derisory about Diana. It was interesting to see the hidden filming of these journalists, and the main thing for me watching it was I didn't realise that the verdict of the inquest was essentially that Diana was murdered, not that it was an accident, because most inquests of car accidents say, well, it's an accident, but this one came out as unlawful killing. Hence the title of the film. Anyway, so what, we've got Diana leaving a note before she died saying, my husband is planning an accident in my car, brake failure, something like that. And then, of course, she dies in a car accident. This is all put forward there. But what about any actual evidence that it was something other than just a horrendous accident, Jason?
Well, I mean, they make an awful lot of very good points there. I mean, the point about the paparazzi being blamed, but the actual paparazzi motorcycles weren't able to keep up with the car. Was an interesting one. They said that Henry Paul was an alcoholic, but it showed that he only actually had two glasses of wine on the night that it happened. It said
that's the driver. He was the driver, Henry
Paul.
Yeah,
he was the driver, Henry Paul. They said that six mysterious vehicles showed up, and no one knows where they came from or what they were. And these, as the inquest said, these were the ones that were given responsibility for the murder. And doesn't actually say that they were paparazzi. That was the assumption of the press.
It's a high-powered motorcycles that appeared around the car at the time. I mean, I can't help but compare this, because we've got the 50th anniversary of the John F. Kennedy assassination, the US president, Democratic president, that was killed in 1963, 50 years ago. Now, anyone looking into that, the suspicious little phrase is the grassy knoll, you know, because the grassy knoll was where apparently there were a bunch of people with high-powered rifles with telescopic sights that actually killed Kennedy rather than Lee Harvey Oswald, who was wandering around without actually his hands on a rifle in the Texas bookstore depository, apparently waiting for a meeting of some sort, but then he was fitted up for it. But with Diana, there's something called the White Fiat Uno. This is almost like a sort of meme, an archetype, if you want, of suddenly you start understanding that there's more to this than meets the eye if you look into the case of the White Fiat Uno that was in the tunnel. I mean, did the film talk about that much?
It did mention that. I think, I can't quite recall what it says, but it pointed out that one of the MI5 agents, I think it was MI5 or MI6, who was closely linked with the Royals, and it was saying that there's no way it could possibly be done by anyone other than the paparazzi, and it pointed out that he was in Paris and was the owner of a White Fiat Uno.
Oh, that's right. Yes, I think, yes. This is the guy who was a photographer who was apparently driving this White Fiat Uno. Yes. And there was the paint from a White Fiat Uno found on the Mercedes. This is one of the few facts that's leaked out. I mean, I just wonder what your thoughts are, Jason, after watching it, as to why it's still being censored, this film.
Well, obviously the establishment in general, and that's all levels of the establishment, probably don't want this being seen.
Well, all I say is, for anyone that wants a copy, I mean, you know, you can write into this show if you want, so sure we can sort you out with a copy or a link to it or whatever, but you can't get this on the internet, because there's a company called Web Sheriff who are paid by, I believe it's the copyright owners, not the Royals themselves, to stop anything going on the internet. But if you do search for there is a review of this show by the Iranian channel Press TV, which you can watch a little bit of online. If I could ask you, you know, what do you think is the main point that the film was making, Jason? What do you say?
The point the film makes is that Diana was murdered, and that the whole inquiry into her death was just a cover-up operation,
including the inquest.
The inquest itself, indeed.
And particularly, the thing that this film does look at is the reporting of the inquest. I mean, people that I've been with when I've seen this film, they always say the same thing at the end of it, as I'm so shocked that actually the inquest proved she was murdered and nothing has still happened about finding out who did it. So, I did sort of jump that on you, but anyway, what was the story you wanted to talk about press regulation and press freedom? Because obviously, we've got a film here called Unlawful Killing, which is banned, you know, so there's no press freedom when it comes to criticising the royal family, I'm afraid, in this interesting monarchy that we thought was a democracy.
Yes,
but anyway,
yes,
what's going on with the rest of the press?
This is interesting. Think talked about Maria Miller and she dismissed conspiracy theories that the issue of self-revolution was being kicked into the long grass. This is pointed out by the private eye that a quick glance at the Crime and Courts Act that was passed in 2013 in April, mostly devoted to the framework of the National Crime Agency, it reveals that some of the more contentious of the Leveson inquiry recommendations have been passed, which involves courts must not just impose exemplary damages on publishers of news-related material who are not members of an approved regulator, but also declares the court must award costs against the defendant. So a publication, like the Private Eye, that declines to join a press-run regulation, as they haven't in the past, if they're sued for libel, even if they win the case, they will still have to pay for both sides.
Even if they win?
Even if they
Well, this just means, doesn't it, that the rich, I mean, it's a bit like Michael Mansfield was saying the other week, the famous defence lawyer, who in fact was involved with the Diana case as well, that actually the only way to win in court in the future, and now even, is going to be to be rich. So it does sound like that the British justice system is just becoming an extension of rich people's bank accounts.
Well, they say justice is blind, but evidently not blind to money.
No. The other thing, of course, is we've got lots of people who were victims of the press over the years. One of the most obvious is Chris Jeffries from Bristol, who was accused by the Daily Mail and other newspapers because of briefings by Avon and Somerset press office, while Colin Port was the chief constable. I mean, he's now fallen out with the police and crime commissioner around here, and he's gone. But we've got a new chief constable and a different kind of attitude to the press in Bristol. So Chris Jeffries has been wronged by the press. Is he going to be one of the people who's going to be regulating the press in the future? Because I would have thought that these are the obvious people to be involved in press regulation, of people who have been badly treated by the press and lied about by the press.
Yes, that is a good point. On the other hand, you could argue that they could be maybe a little too vindictive about it at the same time. So maybe you want people from both sides of the divide on that.
Well, the interesting thing, of course, yes, probably both, but would be that if someone was thinking about writing something about somebody, they would actually check their facts so that they didn't create a monster.
Well, that doesn't happen often, does it?
They were going to create... No, it doesn't. One of the things I was chatting to somebody the other day, Jason, who's works for a company I probably shouldn't mention, but anyway, his sister... was involved in the Winterbourne care home scandal.
And he
said that, certainly according to his family, a lot of the furore that was drummed up over that was actually the BBC editing CCTV footage. So they weren't showing what had actually caused kerfuffles going on between the carers and the people in the home, and just the outcome of it. And that a lot of the people are very severely mentally ill and extremely aggressive as well. And so, for example, putting somebody into a shower can be a way of actually cleaning them when they've got blood on them, for example, and then actually calming them down, and then taking them out of the shower can be a way of cleaning them and then putting new clothes on them. It's a technique for calming people down.
I have a lady friend who I'm not going to mention her name. She is working in a care home. She's a support worker in a care home in Bristol. She was talking to me about how she was attacked by one of the people she was supposed to be having to look after. Now that shook her up a bit. But she did her job well when the police said they were going to take that person down to the station. She didn't want that person going alone because that wouldn't have been the right thing to do. Wonderful woman.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, I mean, if you're editing footage, I mean, you know, we do edit footage here. We edit sound, don't we? On the TV, they do the film and footage. You can actually completely change the sense of what's going on, and that's what they were accusing Panorama of doing. Is saying actually, look, a lot of the things that have been going on at this care home is because the people who are being looked after are actually incredibly difficult to deal with, and also that there's not proper training for people. So it's not just about cruelty. But anyway, what's the next story I think you're going to look at is Lord Rothermere. Now, this is the guy that owns the Daily Mail and our local wonderful newspaper here, the Bristol Post. It used to be called the Evening Post. One wonders sometimes if it's turning into some sort of entertainment magazine rather than a newspaper.
This is again another one. I love the fact that I love the title of this one. It says "The Man Who Hates Paying Any Tax in Britain." Brilliant. it's talking about the fact that the fourth Viscount Rothermere, to give him his proper title.
He lives on an estate down in the near Shaftesbury somewhere, doesn't he, on the Vale of the White Horse. We did some trespassing on his estate once. Well, I say that he's got some footpaths that run across his estate, and one of the first things I came across was a big sign saying "Beware of the Bull." And you think to yourself, well, he obviously doesn't want people using that footpath then. And by the way, isn't it actually illegal to keep a bull in a field where people are supposed to be walking across the footpath?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. It points out that since 1995, 3 years before the Honourable Jonathan Harmsworth, as he was then, inherited the Daily Mail from his father, the third Viscount Rothermere, the group had been controlled by a company called Rothermere Continuation Limited, registered in Bermuda, but run from Jersey. That's too popular tax avoidance.
Okay, registered in Bermuda, run from Jersey.
Yeah,
great. So he doesn't go to Bermuda to actually have the board meetings to have the place where the teleconferences are run from. That are the board meetings. Amazing. So I think this is the other newspapers are going to go to town on this.
It's brilliant. Offshore specialists, companies registered in Britain's Caribbean overseas territories have the advantage of being, in quotes, very portable. How do you like that one, Tony?
Well, I mean, it makes you wonder what happens to the money if you buy an advert with the Bristol Post. Does that go to the Cayman Islands?
Well,
an account in the Cayman Islands, and then
assume so. Oh, well, at least Jersey or Bermuda. Direct. Okay, it's owned by directors of the company. It's owned by an unknown trust administered in Jersey for the benefit of Rothermere and his family. Following an offshore transaction earlier this year, which almost certainly avoided a hefty stamp bill duty, Rothermere Continuation Limited now owns all the voting shares in the Daily Mail and General Trust, and receives more than £10 million a year from the dividends paid annually by what is a highly profitable media group.
It certainly is, yeah. It's a very, very popular paper, the Daily Mail. It's very, very good at digging. I mean, actually, they do dig out some stories, you know, which other papers don't. But, I mean, as most do, they're not just relying on the newswires. They actually have some quite good columnists. They used to have Sonia Poulton, who was quite, should we say, left field, left wing, and she would be very critical of the Conservative government up until last year when she got the sack, which is a great pity because I used to actually quite enjoy reading her stuff in the Mail. But they seem to have gone very, very right wing recently. And I'm not quite sure why. Maybe because they're trying to just simply support the incumbent government. Another story this week, Jason, is about Npower putting up their prices. Now, we've got the big six energy companies, which operate as a cartel. Very, very clever, wasn't it? Privatising electricity and gas. And the way they make their money, these organisations, is they always say, don't they, that, oh, we only make a tiny profit on the distribution of electricity. Npower only do. What they don't tell you, of course, is that they make whacking great profits on the generation. And they have one part of the business, I don't know if Private Eye's got this in, but they have one part of the business which does the distribution and only makes very small profits. And the generation part of the business sells the electricity to the distribution part of the business. And it's a bit like the petrol companies like Shell and BP, because they always say, oh, we can only make a few pennies on the forecourt. Well, yeah, but when you're at your refineries, you're making millions every minute. In fact, probably billions every hour, you know, fantastic amounts of money, ridiculous amounts of money for something which actually is, bizarrely enough, is free, isn't it? Oil in the ground. I mean, it costs hardly anything, crude oil. And all they're doing is putting it through a process. They're making the most massive markup in history. Unbelievable, because they know we all need it.
Yes, sadly true.
Okay, what else?
What have we got next?
Well, we got that was the big six we were talking about there. I suppose we could finish by talking about Roy Hodgson and Rio Ferdinand, because I found that an incredible story. Don't often talk about sport, but Roy Hodgson, the England manager, rather than tell Rio Ferdinand that he'd been dropped from the side, decided to tell a load of other people first, complete strangers.
Oh, that was lovely of him.
On the London Underground, that I'm going to be dropping Rio from the team. I mean, this is such unprofessional behaviour. It's also guaranteed to destroy the morale of the England side. I think Roy Hodgson actually should be sacked just for that idiotic thing. Mm. I mean, you know, if you're going to drop someone from the team, you have to understand you've got to face them up front and talk to them, you know, personally, not talk to a complete stranger and tell them so they hear by the media, you know, by the back door somewhere.
Yeah, that's quite right.
Mm. Okay, any other thoughts about football, Jason?
None at all.
Not this week. All right. No. That's good. Maybe we'll just completely stop talking about sport and we'll do loads more news next week. Anyway, thanks very much, Jason Yiannakopoulos.
Bye bye. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Here's Jeff Sparks with the weekly What's On Guide.
Thank you, Tony. This is What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 25th of October, G Baby I Love You will be performing with support from The Bones at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on 25th of October, Never the Bride will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £12 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Metallica. This group formed in 1981 in Los Angeles, USA, and in their career have released 9 studio albums and several singles and EPs. This is Motor Breath from their debut album, Kill 'Em All, which was released in 1983.
Motor Breath.
Was Metallica with Motor Breath from the album Kill 'Em All. It is worth noting that on Friday, November the 1st, the UK's finest Metallica tribute, Metallica Reloaded, will be performing with Guns N' Roses at the Beer Keller in Bristol. On to Saturday, 26th of October, Lonesome Crow will be performing at the Records Halloween Party at the Records Engineer in Templegate, Bristol. Entry is free and the gig starts at 9:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 27th of October, the Johnny Bruce Band will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Entry is free and the gig starts at 9 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Jeff. That's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our studio guest, Stella Clark, and studio engineer, Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol 0117 989 7733. And you'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. As promised, here's the number for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, 01454 318 753. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye for now. The little bit of 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 the little bit
We'll be right back. Another wonderful record. It's been a great week for records. I look forward to playing that next summer at festivals at dizzying volume, if there are festivals and if I'm invited to do them. New Order, of course, but that's been reinvented, really, by Fluke.